them where they don't feel threatened, right? So
I think it's also a different species. But all right, I've lost my sound sheet. So, but let's get into this, and we can talk more about it in the fun half. I've got it now.
Okay.
A lot of stuff going on, and Well, we'll get to it, but I read a bunch of stuff about Curtis Yarvin, who is the sort of, he was this blogger, Mendacious Moldus or something.
Mendacious Moldbug.
Like classic sort of like libertarian-ish, you know, I've come up with a very clever, you know, whatever it is.
The dark enlightenment, or as I call it, the jerk encirclement.
Exactly. And this guy is in like the Peter Thiel cabal. And this piece was from like 2 years ago, and it outlined what Donald Trump should do in terms of being not so much a dictator, but a monarchist, like a neo-monarchist.
Daddy, you know, as Tucker Carlson referred to him as.
And some of the stuff like that he suggested that Trump do in the campaign, like, you know, say you're going to be a dictator. Get people ready for it, which Trump did. And of course, everybody was like, ha, that's funny. It's very possible that what we're going to see very quickly upon his inauguration are moves that have been outlined like that throughout that. Maybe we'll get somebody on to talk about specifically about Yarvin. I think we've had people on who've mentioned him in the past. Mm-hmm. But so much of Trump's ability to do what he's going to do is going to be a function of two or three things. One, the pliability of the 270-80 just judges and justices that he put on the courts 4 years ago. The willingness of the Senate and the House to capitulate to what he wants. Now, remember, there's only going to be like a two-person majority in the House, and there are two of those people who voted for impeachment. Who knows where they are today in terms of these things? And of course, everybody he's appointing all around him are there specifically because they are people who will say yes to him and never say no. And you really don't need that much of talent at those jobs if you want to bring the wrecking crew in. So this stuff is going to be important. And how do you maintain discipline for a House member? It's not that hard because, you know, you don't have that much resources. Maintaining discipline for Senate members are trickier. And we know Elon Musk has already been out there saying, like, if you don't approve all and rubber stamp all of Trump's appointees, I'm going to marshal the forces to primary you because he's got the money. Here is No Labels, their
No Labels
name of an organization.
How are they still around? Weren't they supposed to field a presidential candidate this time around and nothing came of that?
Well, that, and thank goodness. But their buddy Joe Manchin was in, you know, sitting with Trump and Vance right after he had sunk the ability of Joe Biden to appoint and control the National Labor Relations Board until 26. But here is at No Labels, Lisa Murkowski. And addressing the idea of why won't any of your fellow senators like laugh a guy who has been credibly accused of sexual abuse, of being so drunk that he can't even function at functions for that matter, and a guy who has no particular
experience
in running the world's largest, essentially, institution by on a dollar amount in the world. Never mind, you know, the anti-vaxxers, the et cetera, et cetera. Here's Murkowski.
I think it's going to be hard in these next 4 years because you have an administration coming in that has had an opportunity to kind of see how things work, what didn't work. And now we've had 4 years to think about it, and the approach is going to be everybody toe the line. Everybody line up, we got you here, and if you want to survive, you better be good. Don't get on Santa's naughty list here, because we will primary you. I mean, we are seeing that play out in real time right now with the nominees who have just been named. There's been no committee process on any of them. They're just kind of doing their courtesy calls right now. And my friend Joni Ernst, who is probably one of the more conservative, principled Republican leaders in the Senate right now, is being hung out to dry for not being good enough. And you're going to.
Yeah, except for, this is where Sam gets to take a little victory lap, Ernst caved, or I would say like folded very quickly, and basically because she's a survivor of sexual assault, and she's running in 2026, so she's up for re-election in 2026, she said, maybe I'm walking back my disapproval of Hegseth as a sexual assault survivor.
The irony of this conversation is that she's not mentioning the billionaire Elon Musk who would finance these things, and which makes it virtually impossible for any of these Republican senators to get any, maintain and even pretend that they have independence. Like it is usually what you'll see these senators do is pretend that they have independence or pretend that they have a contrarian view. And then, reasonably get there. What we're going to be in, they're all going to be in the mode within, I think, several weeks of running over each other to be seen as conforming with the president's wishes. And what's really interesting about this, too, it strikes me, is that there is probably no single organization, political organization, I wouldn't know if I would call them a party, but something like that, that is more associated with a higher concentration of its like constituents being billionaires or multimillionaires. Like the dynamic that she's not mentioning is that there is such an enormous amount of money being controlled by certain individuals that just with a switch, that money can flow literally overnight. There's no fundraising that's going on. There's none of that. Elon Musk will just dump, $40 million into any one of these races and completely like capsize anything. And she will not bring that up because everybody who is invested or involved, it's really the same thing in No Labels is just Elon Musk with a little bit less money.
It opens up a whole can of worms for them because Republicans are always kowtowing to the interests of capital, of the donors that are funding their campaigns. But it's a little more crude in this instance because Elon Musk is basically just acting as a mob enforcer for Donald Trump in the form of, instead of, punching people out or beating them up, it's about money. We'll take you out. We will take you out of your seat if you don't abide by his wishes. And it's less associated with like a specific industry group. It's more of like bend the knee to the monarch, to daddy. And, Elon Musk thinks that he'll be able to be the number one power player and even the shadow president in this administration. There was just a story about Tesla, in Reuters, that Trump is looking to scrap car crash reporting rules for that has been hindering Tesla because their cars are crashing all over the place and killing people.
And I just want to make one more point on this. Both parties are beholden to money.
Yeah.
But what's playing out in the Republican Party now, which is slightly different, and this is a problem we have society-wide, is that there is such massive concentration of wealth that you don't even have competing interests amongst the money. The money is always going to dictate our politics as it's structured right now, for the most part, not always, but for the most part. But on the Republican side, it's not even just money. It is a person, literally a person, like you say, who is just Trump's enforcer. Now, of course, he gets his beak wet, too. It goes both ways. But it is we're going from, an oligarchy to just like a full on monarchy. And this is just Trump's little duke who has the army And that's what's going on here. And pay attention to this, because at one point, these senators are going to stop even pretending that they're going to issue some type of independence. I mean, honestly, the only person I think who's in trouble is Tulsi Gabbard, because she's, you know, had a couple actually decent votes in the past. I also think she's dumb. And so they have an easy, ready-made excuse.
Maybe RFK if Mitch McConnell keeps pushing the polio stuff.
We'll see. We've got some stuff to talk about, the polio stuff, later. A couple of words from our sponsors. First is Cozy Earth. I did not have my Cozy Earth sheets on the boat, but I'll tell you what I did have. My favorite sweatshirt, or hoodie, I guess. I wore it today. Cozy Earth stuff is super, super soft. And you check out Cozy Earth Bamboo Sheet Set. Silence nights start with the right sheets. Cozy Earth Bamboo Sheet Set is the ultimate gift this holiday season. It elevates everyday luxury into something everyone will use and absolutely adore. It's the gift of unparalleled comfort, making every night feel like a serene escape. This is the thing with Cozy Earth. Their stuff is made out of viscose, which is from bamboo. So it's incredibly sustainable, it's incredibly durable, and it's also like bizarrely soft. Cozy Earth right now, if you're looking for a gift, has women's stretch knit long sleeve bamboo pajama set and men's pajamas. You want a lounge at home? They've also got, in addition to these pajamas, I brought my joggers on the boat.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite joggers.
You can lounge around in those at the at your place, but then you don't need to change if you need to run an errand.
There you go. Right. Go out with joggers. I want to thank Cozy Earth for sponsoring this episode. Give the gift of luxury this holiday season with 40% off using the code Majority Report at CozyEarth.com/Majority Report. Like I say, Cozy Earth stuff is it's amazing. I got their sheets. You've got a duvet. I know mm-hmm. that. I've got the joggers now. I've got this the hoodie. I've got Cozy Earth towels. All of them incredibly soft, sustainable. Again, because bamboo is literally a weed, and durable. Cozy Earth's goal is to help you create a sanctuary in your home, a refuge from the outside world's demands. Cozy Earth sheets are so breathable, you're going to sleep several degrees cooler. Those are the things I love about them. And they're made with a durable weave fabric that won't pill. They are guaranteed for 10 years. Cozy Earth's use of only the best fabrics and textiles enhances the luxurious sleep softness you will feel. Cozy Earth prides itself on responsible production of its products, and Cozy Earth bedding products have a 10-year warranty. That's how much Cozy Earth believes in them. You can get still expedited shipping until December 20th to ensure it arrives on time. Don't wait. Head to CozyEarth.com/Majority Report now. Use my exclusive code Majority Report for up to 40% off. Give the gift of luxury this holiday season. That's CozyEarth.com/Majority Report. You get a post-purchase survey. You say you heard about Cozy Earth from the Majority Report, and that will help us. But help yourself, honestly. It's great gifts. Also, sponsoring the program today. You got a lot of stuff, obviously, to worry about these days. There is one thing in which you can actually gain some control of and help yourself in terms of the future. And that's what I'm talking about is SelectQuote. SelectQuote will help you get insurance that will give you peace of mind. And particularly, I mean, if you have a new family or, for that matter, an old family and you don't have insurance, now is the time, and this makes it much, much easier. SelectQuote is one of America's leading insurance brokers with over nearly 40 years, I should say, of experience helping over 2 million customers find $700 billion in coverage since 1985. Other life insurance brokers offer impersonal, one-size-fits-all policies that may cost you more and cover you less. SelectQuote's licensed insurance agents work for you, and they do it to tailor a life insurance policy for your individual needs in as little as 15 minutes. Have you ever worried about getting coverage with a pre-existing health condition? SelectQuote partners with carriers to provide policies for a variety of health conditions. You have your high blood pressure, no problem. You got diabetes, that's fine too. Even if you have heart disease, SelectQuote partners with carriers can cover those conditions and others. If you don't have any major health issues, they work with carriers that can get you same-day coverage with no medical exam required. We're talking about life insurance. I went with term. I've got actually two separate term life insurance policies. One with when Milo was born, and then I got another one when Saul was born, a little bit less. And honestly, it's intimidating to go do this. SelectQuote makes it super easy. Help to SelectQuote, head to SelectQuote.com. A licensed insurance agent will call you right away with the right policy for your life and your budget. SelectQuote, they shop, you save. Get the right life insurance for you for less at SelectQuote.com/majority. Go to SelectQuote.com/majority today to get started. That's SelectQuote.com/majority. All right, quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Stefania Barca on her book, Workers of the Earth, Labor, Ecology, and Reproduction in the Age of Climate Change. Want to welcome to the program Stefania Barca. She's a distinguished researcher at the University of Santiago de Compostela in Spain, author of Workers of the Earth, Labor, Ecology, and Reproduction in the Age of Climate Change. Stefania, thanks so much for joining us. Your book is basically in two parts. One is a history that provides instances where we see workers interact with environmental concerns, and not necessarily workers that we, you know, I guess we are sort of trained to immediately assume, you know, a more organized labor that would engage in this type of struggle. And then we go on to talk about sort of the ecology of the politics around this and the ideologies that we see are trying to inform us as to how we go forward. But I want to just start with this question, because some of this is more theoretical and philosophical, some of it, than we tend to deal with, particularly right in this era where there's a lot of like sort of immediate concerns. But will you explain for folks what the difference is? Well, first off, I guess, you know, we've talked about social reproduction on this program. Maybe you could just touch on that. But then I'd like you to contrast it and compare it to what you call reproductive work.
Right. Yes. Well, thank you. First of all, thank you for having me. Reproductive work is, in my understanding, is a little bit larger, broader than social reproduction. It includes both social and ecological reproduction work. Let me explain. By social reproduction, what is usually meant is the work that can be paid or unpaid of producing human beings and socializing them into the different forms in which society organizes itself. So from language to education more broadly, and also the physical needs of human beings, taking care of them, right? So this is the work that mostly women do in all societies for historical and cultural reasons. And this is the reason why social reproduction is a feminist concept. Now, if we look at this work, it needs broader, not only social, but biophysical sphere. Human beings are natural beings. Human beings need to interact with a healthy environment to be healthy themselves and also they also for their mental and psychological development, they need to relate to a good environment, right? A good living environment. Reproductive work to me is the work of making sure that also this environment is healthy and fit for human life and for human development. And this is work because the environment by itself can be subjected to many different forces that reshape it in different directions. So human beings also need to make sure that the environment is fit for human needs and for human development needs. So this is a very abstract and theoretical explanation.
I think it sounds like what we're talking about is an expansion of what is considered within the context of social reproduction. Because even though it's human work that is in many ways making the environment less hospitable, not always, but largely making the environment less hospitable to human society and human life, it's adding another element to which is a pretty big one to, I guess, what's on the menu when we talk about social reproduction.
Yes. Well, here's the trick. It depends on what you define by work. And of course, it is true that in modern industrial economies, a lot of industrial work has been, in fact, at odds with environmental reproduction in the sense that industries have historically been responsible for most of CO2 emissions or radioactivity or other kinds of contamination of the environment, etc. But you see, I think that we should understand that it's not work what has produced that, right? Because it's not workers who make decisions that concern production and the quantity and also the mode of production. So they execute mostly, right, when they are wage workers. So if we understand, so in some cases, workers have actually taken responsibility for protecting the environment. And these are some of the stories that I tell about in the book. And unwaged workers or reproductive workers also have done so historically. So they have struggled to make sure that the environment was safe and healthy and fit for human life.
So for the most part, it's capital that is inhibiting or is making the environment more hostile to human life as opposed to workers. And before we get into unwaged workers versus wage workers, I just want to make sure that everybody can follow, where we're at. Let's just first talk about the tension between labor and environmentalism that has existed, does exist, but in some ways, the history that you offer provides a, not as a counterfactual, but other instances where there is not that type of tension. But let's talk about that tension first and then introduce your examples.
Yes, sure. I think the way I see it, the tension between labor and the environment is a social cultural construct of the 1960s and 1970s that comes from a certain understanding of labor and a certain understanding of environmentalism, whereas labor is understood as male, blue-collar, waged workers, mostly organized through industrial trade unions. And environmentalism is understood as a mostly white, middle-class, urban movement of people concerned with consumerism and the impact of consumerism upon the environment, right? So it's not that this is not real. These are two real segments, aspects, dimensions of both labor and the environment, which by themselves are much broader than that. And in one of the chapters, I I show how in, for example, in Europe during between the 1970s and the end of the 20th century, there were actually different forms different kinds of labor organizations and of labor movements and different kinds of environmental organizations. And they were also aligned in many cases, or they understood each other also as complementary. So the development that this distinction and this opposition between labor and ecology is actually the product of a historical development that could have taken different turns, and it did take this particular turn for historical reasons. So I think this is important. It's important. I'm not going into the details now, but what I gather that is most important from this is understanding how the actual conflicts, the actual divisions and differences are run within the labor movement and within the environmental movement, as well as between the two, right? So we need to be able to see different kinds of environmentalism. For example, there is a kind of environmentalism which is very mostly concerned with green consumerism. There is a kind of environmentalism which is very much consistent with green capitalism and the ideology of green growth. And then there is environmental justice, for example, which is a perspective raised by mostly racialized populations like African Americans and indigenous people, which has a completely different vision of what is ecology and how and what shall we do about it, right? So there is something that is called the environmentalism of the poor, which is documented through a number vast body of research on environmental conflicts around the world, especially in the global south, and concerning rural populations who defend their livelihood and access to land and water and forests as sources of livelihood. So this is also kind of environmentalism. So, I mean, we need to understand that there are differences, and not all kinds of environmentalism are compatible with each other. Sometimes they clash with each other, and sometimes people suffer from that.
The one that you mentioned, though, the individual consumption choices driving how many people perceive environmentalism, that is, I would say, if you were to just survey random Americans, right, I think that often the first example of how environmentalism comes to mind in their daily lives would be, oh, I try to recycle, or I try to consume things in a different way, if they're considering it at all. Do you see that as fundamentally harmful to connecting what you're trying to connect here in your book? And like, is that just capitalism, or was it a series of choices over the course of really the back half of the 20th century that made that the focal point of environmentalism?
Yes, no, I don't see them as detrimental to other forms of environmentalism. I am a white middle-class person myself, trying to recycle as much as I can. So that's my point, is not to single out this kind of preoccupation with environment. My point is that of understanding how this is part of a much, much larger picture. So what we white middle class people do is only a fraction of what really matters to the environment. And this is you're right that this is the way a lot of people understand environmentalism. I see this with my students every year, every single year when I start my course with first year students. This is the way they describe environmentalism, and then for them it's a sort of discovery. An eye-opening experience to discover how many other different people do different struggles, and all of them are really they do matter to environment, and not only that, but how your own actions are only a tiny fraction of a much larger picture, and you need to be aware of the broader picture. For example, let me give you a concrete example. You may think that buying an electric car is your way out of ecological impact that you might have by driving. But then when you meet people who are struggling against lithium mining, for example, in rural areas, not only in the global south, even in within Europe, there are communities who are being affected by this new mining prospecting on lithium, which is essential to build electric vehicles, right? And this lithium mining is going to completely destroy their environment and completely change their landscapes and their mode of life and cut on their access to land and livelihood. Then you understand that driving an electric car might not be the solution, right? And maybe you start thinking about public transport or other forms of other ways of being environmentalist that are more connected to other people's struggles.
And so, I mean, is that ultimately the goal to or part of the project in sort of like delineating these things is to overlay different filters and get a better sense of where the most effective response is. And it's not necessarily just individual choice, right? I mean, this is something that we ultimately want to project onto governments. Let's do though. I mean, I am interested in, you know, maybe as an example, we can talk either about your example of like Italian doctors in the 60s and 70s as an example of the sort of the how we see this play at this type of I guess non-wage labor playing out in these environmental fights. Because when we think about, you know, I mean, we have a perfect example in this country with auto workers who may be disinclined to go with electric vehicles, not necessarily because of how the lithium is mined, but more they perceive it as being a threat to the structure of auto workers. Now, we also have another, a head of the auto workers union now who's like basically negotiating into making sure that we maintain union jobs in these plants and sort of seeing this direction it's going in. But that's the type of tension that we normally sort of conceive of. But give us an example, and maybe it's the anti-nuke movement in the UK with housewives, but give us one of the examples historically that you cover that would make this a little clearer to us.
Well, it's a complicated issue. I'll try to make examples that illuminate the different sides of the problem. Because on one side, we have the jobs versus environment dilemma, no? That environmental regulation, environmental legislation, or environmental policies are jobs reducing. But this argument, of course, it's based on certain kinds of jobs. So you were mentioning auto workers, right? And so, or coal miners. It's another broad category that is very concerned about environmental policies. So how do we respond to that? Historically, there have been we can single out two kinds of responses. On one hand, workers' organizations that have demanded to, in a sense, de-alienate labor in the sense of making workers, or what you would call it, workers' democracy, no? Making workers more responsible, more involved in decision-making at the production side. For example, I don't talk about these examples in the book, but they are pretty much very well-known examples. One is the Lucas Plan in the UK, struggled by a counter plan for restructuring plant of aerospace industry in the UK, and for restructuring that plant into production of socially useful machine. For example, they were developing and proposing to develop new forms of heating, of domestic heating, what that later was actually became the heat pump, that is very, very ecologically efficient, energetically efficient a form of domestic heating. So these workers were saying, we are not redundant. We don't, and to have a job, we don't need to produce weapons to have jobs. We have skills, we have technology, and there is fixed capital here that we can use to produce socially useful things. A similar example was in Australia with the Green Bands movement in Sydney, also in the 70s. Construction workers are opposing urban development in inner downtown Sydney, and claiming the right of working class people living downtown to have access to green space, for example, and demanding a new kind, different kinds of urban planning. So they weren't saying that they didn't want to build. They just wanted to build differently, right? And having a say on how things were built. Then we have a different kind of response, which is more like organized labor in the sense of the trade unions confederations. And they have put together this response called the Just Transition Strategy. And the Just Transition is a way for the trade unions to have a say in ecological transition policies, so that workers, industrial workers, the categories of workers who are going to lose the most, like coal miners, for example, are not left behind. Now, what is meant by this being not left behind is very contingent on different places and situations and regional diversities. But mostly what they are claiming is reskilling workers into different kinds of jobs that can be compatible with the green economy and with green capitalism, because this is the problem. The Just Transition is not an anti-capitalist strategy per se, right? It's simply a way of granting that workers have a say, or how the former Secretary of International Trade Unions Confederation used to say, that if you don't sit at the table, you might be part of the menu. So, right. So this was the perspective.
So the Green New Deal is a that was at least sort of bandied around years ago in this country is of that ilk.
Yes.
In terms of addressing those things. So this is a good time to talk about eco-modernism and what that means and where is that relative to sort of like a degrowth ideology?
Okay. Right. So eco-modernism basically means a way of understanding ecological policies that that rejects ecological primitivism, so to speak, right? Eco-modernism is a claim that ecological policies are compatible with the modern way of life. Right. And so there are different kinds of eco-modernism, but mostly they share a faith in technology and how new technologies, clean technologies can take us out of the crisis. And now there is a sort of, let's say, neoliberal eco-modernism, which is the dominant ideology of the climate negotiations and everything. And then there is what I call labor's eco-modernism. So a labor version of eco-modernism in which workers take control of industrial workers. And here is the trick, no? That by workers and labor and is restricted to an understanding of waged industrial work. And this kind of work takes control over technological innovation and directs it into certain kinds of investments and certain kinds of development, making sure that not only we have ecological transition, but we also have redistribution of the benefits, right? So this is eco-modernism, and the conflict with the degrowth movement is that eco-modernism per se is not aiming at reducing the use of resources or the production of commodities of goods, right? Eco-modernism tells us that we can have it all. We can have a growing economy, we can have more and more and more, and we can have it good. Whereas the degrowth movement tells us that's not biophysically possible. And there is the entropy law, there are biophysical limits that at some point that will demand that we also put some limits to what is to how much resources we extract and how many commodities how much we produce and how much waste we produce. And there is not a technical solution to all of that. This is the basic,
conflict between
disagreement, let's say, between the two.
And does the idea of including within labor non-wage labor workers, whether those people who are involved either in just sort of what we consider social reproduction for no wages, caretakers, people in the house who are taking care of everybody, making sure everybody's getting up at times, and cleaning the house and making the meals. But also that expands to arguably non-wage workers who are taking care of the environment, indigenous people who are maintaining ecosystems and whatnot. Does the inclusion of them within our intellectual perception of what constitutes labor change that tension or the formula between what we consider degrowth and what you're talking about is labor eco-modernism?
Yeah, I believe so. That's what I propose in the second part of the book, in fact. I'm not against eco-modernism per se. I just... first of all, I think eco-modernists are a little bit utopian. They really disregard biophysical limits, and so they should pay more attention to that. But ideologically speaking, I'm not against the idea that we can have all and good. The problem is what we consider good, what we consider as worth doing. And this is not just producing more materially speaking. It is also very much about having more care, right? Not only, let's say, caregiving, but also receiving more care. Not all of us, we have care needs that are not properly met by the social system we're part of, especially the capitalist system. And also, we are not meeting these needs equally. There are huge inequalities in how people have access to care. So if we include that as a fundamental human need and something that would make us all happier and more healthier and happier and more and really taken care of, no? If we understand that as part of wealth and of what wealth is, right? Then this will change our ways of understanding the politics of ecological modernization, or as you want to call it, right? Because it's not just about having more, but also having better, society that is capable of, truly capable of taking care of everyone. I think this is the perspective that feminist movements are taking up, and their particular take on the ecological crisis as connected to a care crisis. And this, and the care crisis, the unmet needs for human needs for care, which includes the biophysical environment and care of the biophysical environment, is nowhere to be found in the eco-modernist horizon. So it's missing.
What you're talking about seems to me as being analogous. I mean, I remember in the early 90s when the Berlin Wall fell and the U.S. was supposed to get some type of peace dividend. And there was a movement at that time in this country to change the way that we calculated. I think at that time we called it the GNP. It's now the GDP. But a way of recalculating by including the expenses of not just, you know, environmentally, you know, what is the cost to us down the road in taking out a forest? You know, it enhances the GDP short term, but we're not calculating the costs that are associated down the road. Or even like if I get my stereo, you know, this is 1993, if I get my stereo stolen, the GDP goes up because I go out and buy another stereo. But there's no accounting for like, wait a second, I've lost wages. Because I've got to take time off to go buy my new stereo, or, you know, I can't buy something else that I could have bought because I had the stereo. It feels like it is an attempt to reorient what we consider to be inputs into the formula in which we assess, you know, what are externalities that are imposed upon us by, you know, corporations or by just simply the way that the capitalist system is working, and what are not. Is that like a good way to conceive of it?
Yes, definitely. And I can tell you that it's not just the ecological movement which was making that point, no, about restructuring the way we understand GDP. The feminist movement was doing it at the very same time, actually. The wages for housework movement was going international at that point in the 80s, actually before 1993. In the 80s, during between the mid 70s and the mid 80s, when there was the UN decade on women, there were lots of women organizations lobbying and struggling, but specifically the wages for housework movement, lobbying for including unpaid care work, unpaid housework and unpaid care work more broadly into accounts of what is wealth, or what is national wealth, what is GDP. And one concrete example I can give you is that, for example, with the struggle against the nuclear power in the UK that I tell about in chapter 3. In that particular struggle that was waged by that particular movement, the point was to say that if the additional caring work would be accounted for in the cost-benefit analysis of building a new nuclear power plant, if they accounted for all the additional unpaid care work that women in particular would have done to take care of the people who get sick, due to radiation risk. They documented how in the Bristol area already there was a higher radiation risk than other areas, and people were getting ill, specifically children were getting ill due to that. Not, for example, the disposal of radioactive waste that was crossing through Bristol and stuff like that, and how black and working class people lived around the most radioactive affected areas, and how the women in those communities were doing all the work of taking care of everyone and also making sure, struggling to make sure that they had access to public health, struggling to make sure that opposing the new central. This was also work, additional work they were doing, right? Organizing at the end of the work of the paid work day and the unpaid domestic work day, they also had to add on top of all that the work of organizing and struggling. So this is a way, very concrete way of putting it. If we calculate the value of all those hours of work, of reproductive work, then in the cost-benefit analysis, then we realized that it's not worth it, no, to build a new. And it wasn't just the work of the domestic work. They were talking about also the cost of disposing of this, of extracting uranium and the cost of this to communities in extractive areas. And they were also talking about the costs of disposing of nuclear waste and the cost of this also to the communities where the waste would be disposed of. So these are the costs, not only caring work, but also environmental costs that are typically left aside when calculating wealth.
For the sake of grounding this a little bit, for what's an example of these ideas, acknowledging the actual dollar figure or value associated with work that is not typically perceived as labor, because we don't associate a dollar value to it, where that idea has implicated some policies that may be, some form of incrementalism, I guess, but where this awareness, actually makes a material difference, or has so far, in some example that you have.
Well, this is actually very, very contentious topic, because mostly this claim has turned into research and also policies that have pushed towards commercialization or financialization of both care, unpaid care, and of nature, let's say non-human nature. So this is why a lot of large parts of both the feminist movement and the environmental movement, they have cautioned about the risks of contabilizing what cannot be contabilized in monetary terms, right? So at the end of the day, the problem comes to the meaning of money, what money stands for in the current system, and especially in the capitalist system. Money is equivalent of commodities. But if you consider life, produce the production of life and well-being and health and all that, of caring and all that associated with caring, and including non-human nature, and they all have intrinsic value, right? So a lot of people reject the idea that we can calculate that value in monetary terms. The way money is understood today, there are, however, Some economists, specifically monetary theory and also feminist thinkers who are pushing towards a huge radical reform of the monetary system so that the monetary system does not reflect market value anymore and it reflects social value, what society gives value to. Oh, now this is a very complex and also risky, tricky terrain where I stop here because I'm not an expert, I'm not a monetarist, I'm not an economist, but it's important for me that we are aware, at least we are aware of the fact that money is a social convention, right? It's so it stands for certain things. It could change what money is and how money is used. This it should actually change. That would make a difference in many, many policies.
I mean, but that's sort of the conundrum, right? I mean, like people can both use the notion of you don't want to commodify what's happening within the context of caring for the planet or caring for other people and in some ways, you know, preparing them to function within a capitalist society. You can decline to commodify that, A, because you don't want to cheapen that in some way. You don't want to cheapen that dynamic. But you can also decline to commodify it as a way within the context of a capitalist system to oppress and devalue what's going on, right? I mean, so that's sort of the conundrum there.
Definitely. Well, the way I see it, I don't have a definite answer. This is a true problem. But in the past few years, I have been involved in the Care Income Campaign, which is an international campaign connected to the Green New Deal for Europe, the European version of Green New Deal policies. And the care income is only one of several policies that were put together in the new Green New Deal for Europe, which is not the official Green Deal of the European Commission, right? The care income demands that governments recognize the needs of carers, especially unpaid carers, and a response to those needs by granting them a basic income. This is a way of demanding money because money is the universal means by which people make a living today, and everybody needs money, and there are particularly the poorest. Those who have the least access to money are also those who are doing most of the unpaid caring work because they don't have access. Mostly they don't have access to a number of caring services which are to be paid for. So this is a way of also recognizing that care work is if people are paid to care, then maybe they don't need to go and get a job in the arms industry or in the fossil fuel industry. So it's also a way to disconnecting people's material needs from participating in a labor market, which is also strictly associated with a number of environmental problems. Right. So it's a way also of responding to people's need for a wage, for a salary, for money. Right. But being able to do what they really want to do. They want to take care of their families or taking care of their communities. We identify different kinds of caring, not just domestic work, right? So community care or environmental care or caring for the food provisioning, no? Producing food on the local level, et cetera, et cetera. These are all forms of care. So if people can be paid to do that recognizing how important is that work to society, then this is also a way of reducing the importance of environmentally harmful jobs for people to make a living.
And I would also say in this country, we have a lot more room probably than in many in Europe to decommodify a lot of things so that the amount that anybody needs to be paid for anything becomes diminished in some way. And it diminishes the importance of money. Stephanie Barca, the book is Workers of the Earth, Labor, Ecology, and Reproduction in the Age of Climate Change. Thanks so much for your time today. We're going to put a link at majority.fm and in the podcast and YouTube descriptions.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. All right, bye. Folks. We're going to head into the fun half of the program. I am still somewhat at sea, trying to maintain my equilibrium. I'm trying not to look at the horizon or just to focus on the horizon.
There we go.
Rather than the computer that is sort of like going like this.
You should watch Last Voyage of the Demeter. I don't know if any of you have seen that. It's a really good horror movie set on a ship.
Pass.
And it'd be, you know, kind of like
passing.
You're there.
I'll be passing on that one. Thank you.
It's my favorite movie of the last few years.
Really? Are you not a horror fan, yes. Sam?
What's that?
You're not a horror fan.
Not huge.
Me neither. So. I don't know, but Matt has a lot of good recommendations. I just can't deal with the blood.
I like boats and horror, so that's a great movie.
Great for him.
Folks, it's your support that can make this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. We're going to round out the year. We're going to have some best ofs starting next week, and we're going to get some rest, and then we're going to come back raring to go. The next year could be extremely tumultuous. If, you know, there are a couple of different scenarios, and maybe over the course of this week we'll talk about those different scenarios, which, you know, my time at sea gave me a couple of days at least to be able to sort of organize my thoughts on this. And I think we've been talking about it quite a bit, but it's tough to catch up on some level. But right. There's a couple of different scenarios, what we could see from the Trump administration. And they range from sucky to really, really, really sucky. If you want to be a part of our efforts to both educate you to where it's sucking the most, how much it's sucking, what you can do to, at the very least, like gum up the works, then you can support our work by becoming members at jointhemajorityreport.com. We've got some stuff that, you know, we're going to do. We're starting to look for more and more action items as we get into 2025, starting to look for more things for you to do that may seem, you know, small and maybe small and will probably have, you know, small impact. But one never knows.
Hmm.
So join themajorityreport.com. Also, Just Coffee. .coop. On the boat, I was talking to John Nichols, and you know, we were recounting the protests of Act 10, which, as far as I know, is still been frozen in Wisconsin, which basically took the ability to form a union for public sector workers in Wisconsin off the table. Except they excluded cops and firefighters because that was politically amenable. But it turns out that is what has bit that act in the patootie, as it were, because then all of a sudden you're treating workers differently for really just arbitrary reasons. There's nothing inherent about being a cop or a firefighter that says you deserve a union as opposed to a sanitation worker. But we were talking about, because John and I ran into each other on the steps of the Capitol, I guess it was 13 years ago now, Just Coffee was out there serving coffee.
Mm.
So justcoffee.coop. I know that's a long way to do it. It was like my Rachel Maddow version of that ad. Emma. ESPN.
Well, okay, before we do ESPN, we should plug that we have those hats back in. Yeah. I know that you're a little bit discombobulated. Not those, although we will be getting a plug for those in just a bit.
Oh, my God. You are so right. You are so ready to do that immediately.
We have what? The, I mean, if we're, I guess Matt and I are in a hot hat competition.
I'm not aware of these.
Or why not both? You were definitely on the email.
I know they were happening, but I just haven't seen them. Whoa.
Limited edition, a majority report baseball
shots fired.
Hats.
Do we really need to cross out my name in that? I don't
know. Yeah. All yeah. Right. I'm okay. Pretty sure we do.
There it is, the limited edition, the Emma Jordy hat.
And then also
mugs are back.
Mugs are back, limited edition. You can pre-order them. The Emma Jordy Report hat is available. You're not on camera right now. Available. Mm-hmm. And then on the other side. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Julie was like, those laurels look cheesy. I'm like, no, they don't. Well, I mean, they do, but I don't.
Wasn't that the point?
Yeah, exactly.
Also, I'm sorry. I dropped one of these the other day and broke them while you were gone.
Buy another one to the GDP.
Anyway,
there's a lot of fighting going on in the studio.
Actually, and by drop them, I mean, I chucked it at Bradley's head. shop.majorityreportradio.com. And then on ESPN today, what else are we going to be doing? We're going to be talking about week 15 in the NFL, how Josh Allen is finally likely to win his first MVP and how deserved it is. Some issues cropping up with the Detroit Lions, and also my Giants are tanking, which I'm very happy about. YouTube.com/ESPN show.
Matt!
And if you want this hat, leftreckoning.com/store.
It's a total like golf. It's like a golf hat, isn't it?
Those are in now.
Classy, yeah. Yeah, exactly. If you want to pretend like you were in a fraternity, even though you went to a school that didn't have frats like I did.
Wait, is that a frat hat?
I don't even know. I don't know.
That just looks to me, honestly, like.
No, it's literally like called a golf hat. It's called a golf hat.
Is it called a golf hat? Because it looks like, it honestly looks like. Back in Worcester in the 80s, I can imagine somebody wearing that exact hat and also like a lime green shirt and sort of like a yellow polyester golf pants.
Yep.
Well, the 80s style is back, so it's right. I mean,
very preppy.
Yeah. I mean, my farmer grandpa would have worn hats like this. This is where I remember these things. I don't know what the thing of the little rope that goes across the
That's
front.
Where you leave notes for yourself and anything you find.
you put your golf card in the land.
Or you put your tees in that, maybe.
Your golf card, maybe, right? If you're keeping track of the score.
But yeah, patreon.com/leftreckoning. We talked about Canada with Jeremy Appel, and we're going to have Nathan Robinson on soon to talk about Matty Glacius. So check that out.
Oh, yeah. We got to have Nathan on here to talk about his book, too. Nova from Connecticut just started listening this week. Who's this almost boomer you brought out of retirement? Well, we'll talk more in the fun half, right? Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh.
Rand Paul.
I had my
my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.
We are back. Sam Cedar, fun half of the program, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back. We got a somebody in the IM, Albs from Seattle, said someone named Cirrus on the MR Discord requested you check the show email. They're an Israeli conscientious objector scheduled to be jailed in 2 weeks. Is offering an interview or a call might be worth a look. Definitely. We can't seem to find it. If they could write back in and just put their Discord name or just something in the subject that would pop it up. And that would be helpful to us, and we can figure that out. And because that is someone it sounds like we would like to talk to. Can I get a shofar for my third traniversary coming up on Friday? It's been a happy 3 years of being a woman. I'm praying to anyone and anything I can think of that Trump won't succeed in making it my last one. Trans rights forever. Congratulations. I've never heard of that term. Buckets and buckets. Sam, what are the chances of a family-friendly Disney cruise event? I mean, we're talking, you know, we're confabbing. I don't know that that's where we're, you know, what we would do, but it's possible. Glass Siegel, ahoy, Sam. I noticed that Tim Pool at age 38 has decided to start regularly using the R word. Seems like his brain is regressing even further. I think, honestly, after our debate and then the election, Tim was like, it's time for him to leave the pretense of being anything other than what he is. And so that I find helpful.
Is that not getting picked up by moderators? Like, isn't the R word?
On Twitter, where I saw him, he called Luigi R word.
Oh, got it. So on Twitter, you can do that, but I guess we'll see. It remains to be seen on one of those streaming platforms.
Paste Lowell. Worcester sex workers are demanding an apology and reparations from the Worcester Police Department, and they deserve it. There's something, you know, I haven't dug into this, but I know the DOJ has now found that there is a problem amongst the Worcester Police Department. This came down while I was in on the boat. The Amazing Grando, ahoy, Sam, take it from me, a very real sailor. The best way to get over post-cruise wooziness is to talk like a pirate for the rest of the day. Light Paladin, why hasn't Biden ratified the ERA yet? That's a good question. I mean, I don't know what the downside of that could be. just a reminder on the ERA.
The Equal Rights Amendment, for people that don't know, it was passed overwhelmingly in 1971 by the House and then 1972 by the Senate. But it needs three-fourths of the states to ratify it as well.
And under the statute that was passed in the early 70s, there was a deadline in which the states needed to ratify this, and that was in 82. Now, the states did not ratify it by 1982.
Virginia was the 38th state in 2020, which would make it, finally, there's been 38 states that have said that, you know, they want to put the Equal Rights Amendment into the Constitution. So the only thing that would be holding up Biden would be if he wants to adhere to the statute that puts the deadline at 1982. My point would be like, who cares? The Republicans don't play by the rules. You don't need to play by the rules.
And the real question is what is the rule? Can you, because look, the amendment process is a constitutional process, right? The Constitution lays out what it takes to have an amendment to the Constitution. We are up to 27 amendments now in our Constitution. I think the last one was 27th had to do with congressional pay. Be that as it may, the point being, if the Constitution lays out this is what you need to amend the Constitution, can that process be changed by the
statute?
The statute.
That's a good point, because they met all of, like, if you have 38 states that ratified and say that women are equal to men, which is what this would be.
Here's another way to make it easier to conceive of this argument.
Yeah.
Could you pass a statute that says you only need two states to ratify an amendment? I would think you cannot. And so then the question becomes, well, can you create a... You can't create a lower bar. I don't think anybody would argue that you could, that Congress could pass a law that says, well, we only need two states to ratify a change in the Constitution, like fully dominated, let's say, Democratic House and Senate and a Democratic president. I don't think you could pass that statute. Wouldn't be constitutional. I think everybody would look at that and say that's obvious. So if you cannot lower the bar to what you need to have a constitutional amendment, can you raise the bar? Because putting a deadline on when that has to happen raises the bar. I mean, I think like the 27th, I think it took decades.
Yep.
And decades. And decades. If I remember correctly, maybe I'm missing it, but I think we looked that up.
I think it was. But
that ratification from the states didn't happen for like 80 years or something.
So just do it. And if the Supreme Court wants to strike it down and say, no, 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 women are not equal to men in this country, then let them do it. But why not? There's no constitutional crisis that this sets up. You are ignoring a timer that was set in the 70s where you could easily do that. Although, you know, Biden was one of the people who voted on this, by the way, as
the 27th Amendment took 200 years to certify.
Right.
So, you know, there is a very open question as to whether it was constitutional for the House and Senate to say that you need these three-quarter states by 1982.
Mm-hmm.
And if that provision was not constitutional, if I had to bet, the Supreme Court would say, well, you can't sever this from that. They would have never, ratified if they thought that they had to do it within 10 years, whatever.
Yeah. But also correcting myself, he came in the Senate the following year, not that same year. But still, it's still very much, he definitely remembers it being
I'm staying in the race.
Yes.
But the bottom line is sign it and take it to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court will probably come up with a reason to knock it down that is like, somewhere like in that, like it'll be like, can you keep, and I would think you can. I mean, the Supreme Court, but he should sign it. Let's just put it that way. In 120 Democrats. You might want to put up a tear sheet of this, Bradley. 120 Democrats signed a letter to Joe Biden. I don't know why it wasn't 200 and, 18.
And
Democrats,
it was
215.
It was led by outgoing, unfortunately, Congresswoman Cori Bush and Ayanna Pressley, who are on the committee about the Equal Rights Amendment, I believe. So
this is the type. I mean, right now, Democrats are looking for things to do to protect people's rights, because there's reason to believe that Donald Trump is not terribly interested in protecting people's rights.
No way.
So
I'm being sarcastic. Yeah, he should definitely do
it.
The idea that we're just going to not do things because the Republicans may fight it in the courts. They fight everything in the courts. Do it anyway. Whatever. Make them own it. Make the stupid Supreme Court own that they're going to vote down an equal rights amendment for the other gender.
And here's my only counter argument as to why Biden might not do it. So Biden signs it. There is a lawsuit. It's unclear to me who would have the standing in this instance, but somebody will find it. It goes to the Supreme Court. Whose job is it to defend the adoption of and the certification of that law?
Well, can you frame that question again?
Who would defend the adoption of that law? Who would be in defense of the president's ability to sign that?
Probably a women's group.
No.
Why?
It would be Pam Bondi.
Oh.
And so the only argument I could see here that rationally could be made, now I'm making this up. It's quite possible they have a different argument, or maybe they just don't want to do it. I don't know. Joe Biden's like, it's a little too modern. But I'm not sure. But I also do think that there could be a theory that if the president were to sign this into law, the ongoing court cases would surely happen during the Trump administration. The people who were charged with arguing in favor of the adoption of this amendment would be from the Department of Justice under a Trump administration. And if they were to say, we're not going to contest this ruling, or go in and lose the case in some way, then you cannot bring it back up. So the idea is wait for the president in 4 years to sign it, defend it vigorously then. So that's
that would be the likely scenario. Bondi's not going to contest it, so they can't bring it up a second time just because it's basically cemented. And
I think if the Supreme Court ruled or was able to rule on this during this time, we may be done, and you may have to start all over again.
I guess.
So, I mean, I think I am. This is complete speculation and conjecture on my part, you know, and so I'm not sure. I want to see more, but that,
let's call their bluff then. I mean, this is not the kind of thing where, like, this equal rights amendment, they could say this is a way for us to cement protections for biological women in this country, and that may be the way that they interpret it. But like, if they're worried about suburban women in any way, which I guess maybe why not? Why would they be after these election results? I could see them also not contesting it in any real way, but maybe you're right. Maybe you're right.
There's a lot of stuff that happens like that. So you got to be careful in terms of, like, you know, from their perspective. All right, let's go do some Emmy in Seattle. Did you guys ever see the interview that Crystal and Kyle did with Sam Butler from Dropsite News just before the election? I'm wondering what you guys think about Thiel's interest in creating a neo-feudalistic society. Seems like Musk is into this too. It's a bit scary when one considers how much power Musk will have over the election. We spoke about that extensively in the run-up to the elections. We've been talking about Peter Thiel's desire. I mean, I think it was 8 months ago, he was on tape talking about how this era is very similar to Weimar Germany, and how this was an era, he thinks it's analogous era in that people are tired of liberal democracy. This is liberal, you know, broadly speaking.
He thinks it's because of the wokeness, but the real reason is because people are sick of capitalism, but that aside.
And that the Overton window, this is a paraphrase, although he used the word Overton window, for new ideas of governance that don't include liberal democracy, or I think he said like some form of socialism are there. And of course, you know what that leaves.
Billionaires.
Billionaires, oligarchs, but also, I mean, monarchy. I mean, and authoritarianism and fascism. Did he look super weird and wet in that video, too? I mean, he always has a sheen, but not so much in that one.
We did play one where he was.
Yes, the one from the other day.
Very shiny.
Yes.
And, Tombs from X-Files.
Inarticulate.
Let's talk about this with Lindsey Graham. It is very hard to imagine what Pete Hegseth could do. I mean, let's be clear. When Matt Gaetz had to drop out of contention to be the Attorney General's office, we only had the idea of a report coming out of the House. We still haven't seen the report. For all we know, it completely exonerates him. And but the idea that there is no information about Pete Hegseth that is out there. I mean, we have former people who worked in his organizations saying they had to fire him very gently because he would get so wasted at organization functions that that he could not actually carry out his job. We have granted it's the secondhand, but we know that the victim had to sign an NDA, a victim's friend out there talking about a situation that sounds a lot like Pete Hegseth at one of these functions, essentially roofied a woman, which he says it was consensual. If people want to believe that this conservative woman was at a hotel, her job was to make sure that Hegseth, got to his room and got up at 7 a.m., which is a weird thing to have to assign to somebody unless you have reason to believe that they may have issues with those type of things. But that she decided consensually to have a one night stand with this guy while her husband and small child were in another hotel room.
He, according to the police, and she also would have had to file a police report where she told the police that he took her phone away and blocked the door and ejaculated on her stomach after he was done, and then later told the nurse. So she went through the extra step of going to the hospital to tell the nurse that something may have been slipped in her drink.
Now, I guess she could be making this all up because, like, Hegseth was just too compelling of a male specimen. And she just, it had been her lifelong dream. But
she went into a tizzy. She lost all sense of place because he was just that that incredible.
It's just like Hegseth's mom. Women just lose their mind for a few minutes.
Oh, that's the other thing. Let's be clear. This is not completely like this isn't the only. His mom wrote an email saying you have a record of abusing women. Now, what is it that she said sometimes, like her husband told her she doesn't think before she acts? Is that what it is? Or
I get emotional.
Anyway, here's Lindsey Graham saying, like, I haven't heard anything, so all's looking good.
The world stage. You said last week that some of the allegations against Pete Hegseth, President-elect Trump's pick to become the next defense secretary, were, quote, very disturbing. Senator, let me ask you, at this point in time, are you prepared to vote yes on Pete Hegseth, and do you think he has enough support to get confirmed?
Yeah, I'm in a good place with Pete unless something I don't know about comes out. These allegations are disturbing, but they're anonymous. I asked him point blank, were you drunk in a bar and got up and said, let's kill all the Muslims? He said no. There's one allegation in a police report about sexual assault. That person has the right to come forward to the committee. But about mismanagement of money, about having a drinking problem and saying inappropriate things. All of these are anonymous allegations. He's given me his side of the story. It makes sense to me.
I just remind you, there is also, of course, that retraction from his mom. Now, to be fair, well, I guess I do know her name. Her name is Penelope. But it's almost, she goes by mom, which is almost very anonymous.
Mom Doe.
It's like, who doesn't know, right? And so really, to be accurate, let me just help Lindsey Graham out here. It's not just anonymous people. To the extent that there are non-anonymous people, like his mom, they have retracted.
Hmm.
Just to be clear, mom retracted for whatever reason. She is goofy that way. All right, go ahead.
He's given me his side of the story. It makes sense to me. I believe him. Unless somebody's willing to come forward, I think he's going to get through. Remember Kavanaugh? Five people accused Justice Kavanaugh of misconduct. Three were outright lies. The other two, I think, were not credible. So we're not going to let that happen to Pete. You're not going to destroy his nomination based on anonymous sources.
Pause it for a second. Do you think most Americans knew that there were five people?
That's interesting.
How many people were allowed to testify in front of the judiciary? And
only three he can completely dismiss.
You know where? Yeah. Of course, he gets the idea for the dismissal from the completely non-ever happened vetting by the FBI, where we now know that the White House said to the FBI, "Do not vet this guy for that stuff."
Yeah, it's interesting that the police report is something he could hand wave away, just like the accusations against Brett Kavanaugh. Three he said were lying, or two were not credible. I'm not sure what that distinction is for him. But in this instance, she went to the cops. And part of why she's anonymous is because she reportedly signed a non-disclosure agreement. And there's apparently like him saying to the press, I would welcome for her to be released from the non-disclosure agreement.
Well,
maybe she doesn't want to. Maybe that would be putting her through a really difficult public display that she doesn't necessarily want to deal with. And she may have gotten money in exchange for her silence. The police report should be enough. In any other like time, I guess maybe I shouldn't say that, because we put Clarence Thomas through, we put Brett Kavanaugh through, and they were all hysterical about that. But even the bar that they say needs to be cleared for an allegation to be credible, that bar has been cleared. She went to the cops and to the hospital, and it doesn't matter.
Yeah, that's not anonymity. Anonymous is like a blind item in like TMZ or something. Going to the police.
Well, she
evidence.
Hasn't subjected herself to
Tim Pool's
all
new
sorts
law.
Of death threats from right wingers. So therefore, not anonymous. Go ahead.
I forgot about the Rapist Empowerment Act.
Exactly.
Happened to Pete. You're not going to destroy his nomination based on anonymous sources. People have to come forward and make credible allegations, and we'll see if they do.
Well, Pete Hegseth did sign a non-disclosure agreement with this person who came forward to accuse him of sexual misconduct. Do you want to see that? Should that type of information be released? Do you want
to
hear
from said, yeah, yeah, he said, yeah. Yeah, he told me he would release her from that agreement. Yeah, I mean, think about what we're talking about. I'd want to know if anybody nominated for a high-level job in Washington legitimately assaulted somebody. I've known Pete for years. I met him in Afghanistan. I've heard nothing but good things about his service over there. He's a friend. The Pete Hegseth, I know that this is not a problem I've been aware of. However, if people have an allegation to make, come forward and make it. Like they did in Kavanaugh, we'll decide whether or not it's credible. Right now, he's being tried by anonymous sources. That will not stand.
Mm. I'm sorry. It's not even, Welker, it's not sexual misconduct. He was accused of rape. He was accused of rape. Like, forcible rape. Was accused of that, with allegedly taking her phone away and allegedly blocking the door. With a police report and a hospital visit. So, gotta say, I don't necessarily trust what Lindsey Graham determines is credible or not credible.
Yeah, well, in if you want accountability for a rape, you need to debate your rapist on a public platform.
Basically.
Gotta debate me, bro.
Show your face, you coward.
Don't go to the police station. Let's have a conversation on
I mean,
on TV.
Let's go to on PBD.
Well, you know, there is an argument that it is so hard to find someone who would have the deep institutional knowledge of the Defense Department and the massive experience in running an organization. You can't just people who have run organizations with an annual budget of $11,000 don't just grow on trees, folks. And the beauty of that, that's the sweet spot. If you find someone who has run an organization with an annual budget of under $15,000 annually, that's the kind of perspective they're going to be able to take and apply to an organization that has an annual budget of approximately $900 billion. Because what happens is that, like, they have a certain amount of humility. If you guys start getting somebody who's like run an organization with like a $10 or $20 million annual budget, or even like $100 million annual budget, or even $1 billion annual budget, or has had any management experience whatsoever, they're all cocky.
Mm-hmm.
They don't pay attention to stuff.
Come on, Sam. Politics is local. Like, so the smaller you get, the better that you can apply that to leading an agency that,
Greg from Arkansas has very aptly coined this phrase to explain the anonymous sources coming from inside the Hegseth home when he was a child, and that is Anonymom sources.
Anonymom.
That's good.
We need you to be Mamala of the country.
Oh, jeez.
Did that happen?
Well, we really got to pay. We've got to get Kavanaugh's Ask the Moms out. You got to
Oh, yeah,
that.
I know. I got to find that.
We mentioned earlier that this guy, Curtis Yarvin, and there are, you can Google him and find a lot of stories about this guy. He is the intellectual touchstone for people like J.D. Vance and Peter Thiel and Blake Masters. And probably, you know, to the extent that he has one, even Donald Trump Jr., I bet, is enamored with this stuff. And all the tech pro stuff, and maybe Elon Musk to a certain extent, they are cut from the same cloth. And it is, understand, when we talk about a monarchy, right? What are we talking about? We had two professors on, I can't remember what the book is. You can look it up. It's the anti-oligarchic constitution. And the idea was that when this country was founded, there was no necessarily concept of oligarchy in the way that we understand it today. Because people, like civilians, as it were, I don't know what better to call them, did not have the ability to amass huge sums of wealth. Because the king would say, hey, wait a second, dude, you don't collect more than me. I could give you a taste. You could be a duke. You can be whatever. But we had feudal systems. We had monarchies. And when the Constitution was written, when they were talking about it was William Forbath and Joseph Fishkin. When the Constitution was written, it was against the idea of oligarchy. But what that really meant, you know, what it meant in that day and age was we're against the idea of a monarchy. But what is a monarchy? It's simply the person who gets to attain the most amount of power within a society. It was religion. This guy was just the first, like, you know, first into a market with like, oh, wait a second. God said it was me, and happened to convince enough people who gave them his weapons and or their, you know, willingness to fight on behalf of that guy and loot and get all the money. And so in that age of monarchy, there was no oligarchy. It was the same thing. The oligarch was the king. And anybody who was around him was also like, you know, dukes and stuff like that. And they could be arguably, I guess, the oligarchy. But it was really, that's the way that things worked. And now we have these modern day would-be oligarchs. They got the money. We have a plutonomy, but they want a plutocracy. They want their domination of money. You know, because we have now a situation where, like, the top four wealthiest people in this country have more money than like 60% of the rest of the country combined. They want to turn that into a plutocracy, and to some extent, we've had that. Money definitely dominates, but we're talking about like a handful of people, and those handful of people, their buddies want to get in on this too. And so when we're talking about like Peter Thiel, we're talking about Elon Musk, we're talking about J.D. Vance, we're talking about Blake Masters, we're talking about Curtis Yarvin, who is of that circle and may not have the same amount of money. We're talking about that way, the Slack guy who owns Rumble. Here is Mark Andreessen. This was the guy who was out there saying on Joe Rogan that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was trying to debank people when, in fact, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was trying to protect people from being debanked. But he claims that Elizabeth Warren is actually like has a secret lair
puppet master,
controlling everything the Consumer Financial. And this guy's, I don't know if he's just a blatant liar or an idiot, but nevertheless, here is Mark Andreessen.
Looking like Conehead over there.
But they are gearing up to create the rationale for Donald Trump to be a, what they call, they would call sort of like a monarch, like a modern day monarch. And part of the reason why they want him to be the modern day monarch is it means that they become the modern day oligarchs.
This too, right? Which is like, okay, how do we actually like redo the system is, of course, much harder. The other lens on this that I think about a lot is Curtis Yarvin, who's also a good friend of mine. And the way he describes the American system that's running the people, the way he describes it is we are living under FDR's personal monarchy 80 years later without FDR. Right. And the reason he describes it, he says, look, when before FDR, the federal government was actually very small. Like the tax rates were like super low. The federal government didn't do very much. The FDR dramatically, orders of magnitude.
I'm not a history major, but Matt, I know you follow history. So FDR gets in there and just like.
Big government time, losers. Elections have consequences. That's what he said. I mean, you look at...
Wasn't there something that preceded...
Yeah.
I mean, Age, which was also talk about big government, just giving the first major corporation, which is railroad companies, have that land. for it. It's free real estate, basically.
I feel like something happened after the Gilded Age.
Yeah, I think a giant crash where a bunch of people got wiped out.
Why did FDR create his own, what did he call it, his personal monarchy? Why did he do that? It must have just been for self-interest or something like that.
Or because he replaced like the DuPont monarchy, which is what all these guys really want. They want the malefactors of great wealth that FDR got rid of, and he was right to do so.
But also, think about this concept. Why would you describe what exists today as a monarchy without the king? That's called a system.
A republic.
It's called a republic. And but if you wanted to have a new monarch, you need to say we're already living in a monarchy. It's just a question who gets to hold the title.
Right.
And so they've got to go back literally 90 years to say that guy's still king. Isn't it time for a new king? Because if they concede the fact that actually, no, what happened was is that FDR was able to, and in many respects, just let the air out of the tire of the enormous anger that was in the country.
I mean, save capitalism, really.
And institute, really what they're talking about is Social Security. I mean, that's what they're talking about.
Right.
They're coming after Social Security. The thing that kept two-thirds of our elderly out of poverty. The idea, and understand, Social Security is not in and of itself a decommodification. But it does, in some respects, provide a maybe what you could call a soft decommodification of the ability to live, to have a retirement. Right? And they hate that. Because if you are terrified about having to eat cat food in your retirement, you are going to have a lot more zeal in the workplace, which means basically they can drive down wages.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. Because the leverage for the capitalist economy is survival. And if you know that you may not have to take any job that is right in front of your face because you're not going to be living in abject poverty as a senior citizen, it makes you a little bit too soft in their mind.
It's the same reason that they are obsessed with border fascism, essentially making the border and immigration as difficult as possible, is because a lot of our economy and their wealth is based on cheap labor that is performed by, in many ways, undocumented immigrants, sometimes children, who take as whatever they can get because they are under the threat of deportation and they don't have like the standards that would apply to other labor forces, like minimum wage and other protections. And that's why you see stories like, hey, this migrant kid died in this meatpacking facility at 2 a.m. What were they doing there? Whoops, they were making our economy go so guys like Mark Andreessen and Elon Musk and Peter Thiel can put another bill in the bank.
The engineer type of guys that really follow this stuff, Silicon Valley guys, try, like, they act like, I saw a quote about David Sachs, like, he operates from first principles. Well, here's some first principles regarding the two things Emma just said. If you support A, money crossing borders with zero limits, crypto, and B, hardened borders for laborers, you are a fascist. There is no way around that. You cannot, those two principles, you either support both or regulated both, but you cannot support completely open money transfers and completely closed labor. And it's like this idea that these guys were left wing. Mark Andreessen had to apologize for saying that colonization was good for India in like 2016. And he's the one who, what's his name? Pearlstein said, he had the quote, "I'm glad there's OxyContin and video games to keep people quiet and rule America." So these are the populists we're talking about.
Oh.
The FDR dramatically, like orders of magnitude increased the size and scope of the federal government. He did that for two reasons. One was the New Deal, and then the other was World War II. And so the federal government that Franklin Roosevelt left behind in 1945 when he passed away was the government that he had built, which he had run the entire time from 1933 to 1945 himself, in which he had staffed himself and he had overseen himself and everything. And he built this, basically this giant structure. And as Curtis basically says, as long as you had FDR running that, it could run really well. And, you know, we won World War II and saved the free world and like it worked and pulled the U.S. out of depression. Like the whole thing worked and it was great. But if you let an organization of that size and scope run without its founder CEO for 80 years, you end up with what we have now, which is just like basically an out of control bureaucracy, like an out of control system in which people can't even make positive change, even if they want to.
Oh, and again, I'm sorry. That's why founder CEO. So we have to overhaul the federal government every time there's a change in the executive branch, apparently, because otherwise that would be monarchical.
This is what
Tim Pool said in that conversation about treaties, where he's like, this treaty is so old, like it's out of date. I don't even know, like, why? Well, we should just do away with it. No. This is what having a government is. Having structures, having programs, having institutions that build over time, that can benefit the collective population. And there's been no social program in this country more successful than Social Security. As you say, it keeps on, at this point, it's over 50% of our seniors out of poverty. It's up to two-thirds based on some other studies. Like, The fact that he would describe that as monarchy, it's such disingenuous framing to justify one's looting of the federal government. Because they're saying that that was monarchy, but now they're saying, well, but we're in favor of our own kind of monarch. Yarvin, who well, he references,
he
said...
He sort of set it up right there. He's like, you know, as long as he was running things, it was okay. But then we had a monarchy without the monarch, and things just got a little bit out of hand.
Act like neoliberalism never happened.
It's also, here's the thing, and then you know, mention this sure. Yarvin thing. But here's the thing. Democracy, the point about democracy is not that it's the most efficient system. Let's just be clear on that. Like, yes, a dictatorship probably more efficient in some respects. You can make much more massive mistakes, of course, because you don't allow the input of the people who are governed. And so it can be pretty miserable for the people beneath. And maybe they come and lop off your head at one point because you have no idea how angry you've made everybody. But the idea of democracy is not that it's supposed to be, you know, a lean and mean, you know, corporate
entity.
It's supposed to keep people like him in line.
Exactly.
No, it's just this is the quote. In 2012, he had a speech on how to reboot the U.S. government. Yarvin wrote, if America wants to change their government, they're going to have to get over their dictator phobia. So that really says it all. It's a little bit more, I don't know, I don't know how describing it as a monarchy benefits Andreessen here, but maybe it's to say
monarchy
that
sounds better than dictator.
FDR was a monarch. Now, hey, whatever Donald Trump does unilaterally, it's better than a monarchy. This is the guy that's just getting things done and dictating.
Look at my crown. Go ahead.
In which people can't even make positive change, even if they want to.
Yeah.
And again, that's why you could have in the U.S., you could have reason for optimism, which is, okay, what do you need? Well, you need another FDR-like figure, but in reverse, right? You need somebody and a team of people around them who's actually willing to...
How stupid are these? FDR in reverse?
Yes.
RDF.
Well, somebody, you know, FDR built a lot of things that are great.
Take
like
down the Hoover
Dam. And yeah, we need somebody to tear it all down. FDR in reverse. What a psychopath.
In reverse, right? You need somebody and a team of people around them who's actually willing to come in and like take the thing by the throat and make the changes. By the way, make the changes that FDR would probably make if he were here to make them, but he's not, right? And so somebody else has to step up and do that. It has to be a president because nobody else conceivably has the power to do that. But, you know, we will see how much this president can do. But, like, that's a lot of what this means.
What if we had AI FDR and we could just ask him how to do it?
That's a good idea.
It would have to be reverse AI FDR.
Right. Well, it's
reverse AI reverse FDR.
He speaks in Pig Latin.
You read the Social Security statute, but you read it back from, instead of left to right, right to left. And then it tells you how, actually, we should grind up all the pores for biofuel or whatever.
Think about this, okay? If you were trying to do a reverse FDR and you were inputting into your AI machine and you were saying like, we need someone, a figure who is like, you know, here's FDR, who would be over here? Like, you know, opposite him. And now understand FDR, of course, you know, he would be very old timey today.
He would love what the Silicon Valley guys
are
doing.
But I mean, if you were to sort of try and like compare him to somebody today, it would be very difficult to do because, you know, how do you account for the 90 years since FDR more or less has died, 80 years? So what you need to do is you need to find someone who was opposite him in that era. And
someone who had anti-polio.
Somebody who was like, you could actually do an apples to apples, like a contemporary.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Who would be opposite FDR.
Okay, I'm starting to see where you're going with this.
Like, you need to look at that era
and
find who would represent somebody who was like, not so much like messy democracy stuff, but like more like, get the trains running on time. And so you'd have to, that's the only way you could actually make an anti-FDR. You'd need to model after that person.
After.
Yeah. And you need to think very hard about Germany, who's that person would be, because you want them to have almost a, like, the opposite.
Like an adversarial
of the,
relationship to FDR.
FDR, yeah. Even down to the accent. You understand?
Yeah.
That's what we've got to do. Now,
we need to get over our dictator phobia.
Good enough at history to sort of figure out who that figure would be. But
there's
that's
multiple
what
options.
We need to look for.
Oh, we should just make Netanyahu the president of the United States, and then we're all set.
There you go. Let's. Is there any more to this, sir?
Somebody else has to step up and do that. It has to be a president, because nobody else conceivably has the power to do that. But you know, we will see how much this president can do. But like that's a lot of what this administration plans to do. In the UK, you know, look, the UK government maybe grew up in parallel with the US government, so maybe FDR is also partially responsible for it by inspiring, you know, the general modern Western style of governance. But also, of course, the English system grew up for, you know, many centuries before that. You know, it may be time for an FDR style transformational leader to come in and like really get a grip on it.
Yeah, the path. The path it, dependence. Right. I always, you know.
The path dependence. Yeah. Are you guys talking about politics, or are you talking about like some sort of like pseudo pharmaceutical treatment for electrical?
The thing is like if you enrich your mind with concepts like path dependence or I don't know whatever, you don't need to actually learn any of the content of like, oh, hey, that thing you said about where maybe the UK government was influenced by FDR the whole time. Like, no, they have their own goddamn history, you moron. They were literally the world leader. After World War II, they got rid of Winston Churchill. They said, hey, we're kind of done with the war stuff. We would like national health insurance. Or not even insurance, a national health service. Quite a different
yeah,
little
lineage. Yeah, but Matt, you're
the path dependency.
Your thinking is like the train, the democracy train is going down. It's a little bit off the track. He wanted to like just jump the rails.
Here's a concept. Dunning-Kruger. All y'all should look it up before you do a single goddamn podcast.
Yeah, it explains the Jordan Peterson phenomenon as well. Man, these people are freaks. It's interesting that they don't go after LBJ or Medicare or Medicaid in that example. Do you think that it's just because underneath it, Mark Andreessen thinks that FDR is a class traitor?
I just think that it's they I mean, I can tell you on when I've mentioned this 9/12 thing I did with Glenn Beck. I went down there and there were a lot of people I ran into who were like, this country has been screwed up since FDR, because Social Security was certainly not the first. I mean, look, the radical Republicans were trying to introduce introduce things like public education, which, you know, they'll come for next. You know, this is just like, but you don't get Medicare without Social Security.
Yeah.
You know, and the there are people who believe that the country is much worse off because we allow people to make mistakes in their lives and don't have their whole lives dedicated to making sure they're able to eat. I mean, let's be clear. Is it a mistake if in 1925 you could go down to the Bowery in New York City, and by the Bowery, I'm talking like it, we call it the Bowery still. I don't know if people still do that, but it's Bowery. It's a street.
Right.
They called it the Bowery because there were literally 20,000 human beings sleeping on the streets there at night. 20,000 people without a home on any given night. And there was just enormous poverty. Now, maybe they were all just lazy, and maybe they are all just stupid and didn't know how to plan for their retirement.
And we weren't letting cops be cops.
But, This is what they want to return to. This is what they want to return to, because the fact is that if you impoverish those people, right, like the money they put into Social Security, they can't touch it. George Bush wanted to privatize Social Security, and by that, he wanted to have the money go into the stock market so that it can be played with by the investor class so that it could be used to finance the whims and the adventures of the entrepreneurial class.
The gamblers.
The gamblers. And, you know, maybe it'll pay off for some people, but it makes it much easier. They don't want that money locked away and kept out of their hands. And I don't know if these psychopaths like purposefully want to impoverish a huge swath of people, but they know that's got to happen for them to have more.
And
it's
think
a zero sum thing. I can't be rich enough to have $1 trillion because those people, and by those people, he's looking at 40% of the population, 50% of the population. They got my money. They're sitting on my money. This is the exact same equation of like, why are we going to Iraq? Because they're sitting on our oil.
Think about what this means within the context of what we've been experiencing for the past few weeks after the shooting of the United Healthcare CEO. You see what happens when we've essentially given, until you get Medicare, your healthcare is in the private sector. It has created a situation where these healthcare companies are able to use that leverage, use the fact that it's outside of the public good to jack up prices and to deny people care for whatever it is, even though we have the patient protection part. There are ways that, like, so people know they're paying in and it's on a very high rate, higher than it needs to be because it's fully privatized on a monthly basis. And then they call and they need their surgery or they need health care. And there is an incentive for those industries to deny them care because they make more money if they're just taking your insurance money and not giving you the care that you need. And like, that's what they want to do with your retirement. That's what they want to do with the socialized part that we do have with our health care, Medicare, and even, you know, Medicaid, if you're eligible for that as well. And so that's the situation that we're in. Like, we're already in this second Gilded Age period, arguably. And then you still have guys like Andreessen coming out there and saying it's not enough. It's not enough, the stratification of wealth in this country. We need to take the social programs that are working, the barely functional, like the bare ones that we have in this country versus other similarly developed nations, and also make those privatized and gouging.
That's why FDR was great in his coinage, the economic royalists. For out of this modern civilization, economic royalists carved new dynasties. I would say the Silicon Valley guys are a new version that have not really contributed much to society. New kingdoms were built upon concentration of control over material things through new uses of corporations, banks, securities. Oh, all these guys, by the way, supported bailing out Silicon Valley Bank. Speaking of the small government we need to get on. Through new use of corporations, banks, and securities, new machinery of industry and agriculture, of labor and capital, all undreamed of by the fathers, the whole structure of modern life was impressed into this royal service. We need to take the power back from these royalists and not crown them with the actual government crown.
Or crown them with credibility that they don't deserve. So the idea that there is a populist right that is going to deliver for you in any real way. Listen to what Andreessen says. They are resentful of the fact that they can't gouge you more. And it's about giving the people who have the capacity to play with our economy as a casino more bites at the apple, as it were, to get richer and richer and the rest of us be damned. There is no equivalence. Like, we're in this period where the Trump administration is going to attempt to both loot the federal government, destroy the administrative state, and in the process, deliver for the wealthiest in this country in a way that they is going to further stratify income in this country.
Let's check in with one of our favorite anti-vaxxers. With the potential of RFK Jr. being, he's been nominated, whether he gets confirmed or not, we shall see, to Health and Human Services, or I should say Secretary of Health and Human Services. One of the guys that he's floating, I guess, is a lawyer who and he's I don't know if he is He's going to be appointed by RFK, but he has been advising RFK. And in the course of this guy's lawyering work, has asked the Food and Drug Administration to revoke its approval of the current polio vaccine because it's not been tested against the placebo. Now, let's be clear. It is considered medically unethical to, when you're talking about something like polio, when polio back in, what was it, in the 40s or the 50s, you had something like, in this country, in the late 1940s, 35,000 people, and I would say my guess is off the top of my head, our population in this country was about a third, maybe a little bit less than what it is today. 35,000 were paralyzed from polio every year. 35,000. The vaccine came online in 1955. It became 100 people by the 1960s. So just to give you a sense of what the polio vaccine. So the idea that you would give a some kids the polio vaccine and then other kids, nobody knows which is which, right? That's the way you do the experiment or the placebo test. It's completely medically unethical.
Yep.
Here is Jimmy Dore. Again, it's hard to assess. Stupid or evil in the sense that he would spread these anti-vaccine lies for money. It's hard to assess. They're not mutually exclusive. And do I mean evil and like cartoonishly? No, I just mean like he's like these rapacious corporate executives who he claims to be against in that he will privatize the profits of his vaccine denial and externalize the cost to society in the form of diminished public health. And here he is taking a kernel of truth and twisting it and warping it in a way that is extremely dangerous. And let's be clear, he's doing this because he's attacking Peter Hotez, who amongst the class of people who develop vaccines, maybe not the only one, but certainly the most prominent one, to decommodify vaccines, to undercut the entire premise of why these anti-vaxxers think these vaccines are bad, or at least the only sort of like rational explanation they have.
The shadowy intellectual property regime.
Exactly. And so here is my favorite is he asked Siri for backup on this because the guy never reads anything anyways. Jimmy Dore is what is basically, I guess, Tim Pool without the beanie and with a middling comedy background.
And with the why I left the left shtick luster having worn out. So all he is just like a kind of stale hack.
Old crank.
Here we go.
Outbreaks this year, we've got polio that's been in the wastewater in New York State.
So you know where the polio, it says polio's been in the wastewater in New York State. You know where that polio came from?
No.
The vaccine. That's another, he doesn't tell you that. So there's the oral vaccine, which we give to poor countries. And what is that? That's got a live virus in it. And that ends up a lot of times causing polio in people.
Wait, should I stop drinking wastewater?
But we covered that story. So yeah. I know that that's where that polio came from. They said it didn't come from nature. It came from a vaccine. The live virus vaccine. I know that because I covered that story.
What if I fart into a pillow?
I just want to say, like, He's so proud of himself because he actually remembered the vague outlines of a story. Now,
I've got object permanence.
I want you, I want you to just like stop for a moment and try and put yourself in the minds of the whatever addled, you know, minds of people who listen to Jimmy Dore on a regular basis. And think for a moment how they're absorbing this information. There's an oral vaccine, and that's the way that people catch polio, right? I mean, this is what he's telling them, that the vaccine is a net negative. All right, just continue with this because he's going to back it up by asking Siri.
Polio in the wastewater in New York come from?
Have been lymph samples found in Israel and London wastewater. The strain found in Rockland internationally was derived from an old-fashioned oral. It came from the vaccine, from the oral polio vaccine. Do you see how this guy's just lying to you? Do you see how he just lies to you about everything? He's Marco. Lying to you.
Now, Hotez,
he's lying to you about the.
Now, Hotez is saying the problem is that people are unvaccinated. But Jimmy's trying to make like, no, the problem is that people are vaccinated. The oral vaccine is where this came from and where this person got paralyzed. But continue. Let's just listen to a little bit more because I'm going to read you the actual story, which makes it very clear. The dynamic is the opposite of what Dore is talking about. The specific fact that he's talking about is true. But the way that Dore is, either because he's too stupid or because he's too nefarious, reinterpreting it to make it sound like the real danger is the vaccine to polio, not polio itself. Go.
Vaccine. Do you see how this guy's just lying to you? Do you see how he just lies to you about everything? He's
Marco.
Lying to you. He's lying to you about the polio vaccine.
Yeah.
He's lying to you saying that polio's come back. Because of anti-vaxxers. No, it came back. It came back because it's in the oral vaccine.
So pro-vaxxers caused it, is what you're telling me.
Oh,
this guy's lips are moving. He's lying.
Okay. The last year.
Okay. So there it is. I mean, like, even his dumb sidekick. So you're telling me that polio exists because of the vaccine now. And let's just walk through this because, look, I don't give a shit about Jimmy Dore. But everything he says,
this is dangerous,
is not just dangerous. He is repeating the dumbness and the nefariousness and frankly, the greed of like a whole cohort of people in this country, not the least of which RFK Jr. So this is a story from October 4th, 2022. There was a guy suffering from paralysis after contracting polio. It was the first known U.S. case in nearly a decade. The first in New York since 1990. The patient was unvaccinated. My guess is, it doesn't say it specifically.
There's a whole line devoted to it. The patient was unvaccinated. It's a whole paragraph to itself.
My guess is, being from Rockland County, I suspect, and this is not terribly relevant, although, that this is a fundamentalist, a Hasidic Jew in that community. They have very, very, very low vaccination rates. Again, in the 1940s, the reason why a polio vaccine was developed was because more than 35,000 people annually were paralyzed. This is a country a third of the size of here. That would be equivalent to, you know, 15,000, 120,000 people a year, not just sick from polio, paralyzed from polio. By 79, polio had basically been eliminated in the U.S. But something interesting happened in the world. I'm not sure when actually ship travel started, but just because you've wiped out polio in the U.S. doesn't mean that you've wiped out polio everywhere. I mean, that's why they had to go in and vaccinate in Palestine. Now, I wonder if Jimmy Dore was going to argue that the Palestinians should not be vaccinated against polio, because we know how dangerous that is for people to be vaccinated. But I'll continue. They found this polio, and they were able to analyze the strain. Where did it come from? And they believe that the virus originated overseas in a country that still used the oral polio vaccine. Why do they use the oral vaccine? It's probably cheaper, probably lasts longer. They can probably deliver it better. America stopped using that vaccine more than 20 years ago. It contains a very small, weakened live virus that sometimes can mutate to become more virulent. Now, keep that in mind, because this is the important part. That is the important part. They did this genetic analysis. They think that it's one used in the... When that weakened virus circulates, and it does circulate, it circulates in other countries. Eventually, somebody comes to this country. Even if you have that oral vaccine in you and it has helped you, you can still... it comes out in the wastewater, particularly, you know, like within a certain period of time in which you've used it. If it comes in contact with an unvaccinated person, not a vaccinated person, a vaccinated person is not in any way subject to that even mutated version of that weak virus, because they are vaccinated against it. But if it comes in contact with an unvaccinated person, it can hurt them. Now, let's be clear. Two of the three naturally occurring polio viruses have been eradicated in the 21st century. We still have another strain that is out there. It's very dangerous. Again, 35,000 people in the U.S. In a place like Gaza, for instance, the polio could spread enormously, and you'd have the percentage of kids there that could be subject to paralysis would be through the roof. As recently as 1988, polio paralyzed 350,000 children annually across 125 countries. Today, Pakistan and Afghanistan are the only countries in the world where remaining wild-type polio is still endemic, so it's floating around there. But, you know, people from India and Pakistan, they travel to other countries. And the reason why it doesn't really become endemic in other countries is because the rates of vaccination there, either orally or in terms of a needle, are high enough that it contains it. You can't have it spread like wildfire. There is 27 cases confirmed this year. The annual number of wild polio viruses has declined by 99% since 1988. And that is because of not placebos. Oh, good shit. Guess. It was going to be one or two. It was either going to be one or the other. It was either placebos or the polio vaccination. So recently immunized people can pass the oral vaccine virus to others for a few weeks. But again, it is not normally a problem because the strain is weakened, so it does not cause disease in anybody. But, and in fact, it can actually help build immunity because it's weak enough that it's like almost like getting the oral immunization yourself.
And that's how vaccines originally worked, basically.
The problem begins when immunization rates are so low in a community, let's say up in Rockland County, maybe in a Hasidic community, that the weakened virus from the vaccine spreads uninterrupted for a prolonged period and mutates into a virulent strain called a vaccine-derived poliovirus. And when people who are not immunized catch the mutated vaccine-derived virus, they can become paralyzed, like the patient in Rockland County. Now, the idea that that individual only got polio because of the oral vaccine is baby-brained. Because if you eliminate the vaccine, oral or injectable, the polio vaccine since 1955, people would be getting polio at a rate that I don't know that we could even imagine right now. Because if in the 1940s, you were having 35,000 kids a year get paralyzed by polio, it's not just, well, times it by three. We have 330 million people in the country now. Maybe then it was 110. These are just rough numbers. Times it by three, then we would only have, you know, whatever, 110,000. No, because it would accelerate. That's what epidemics, pandemics do.
We're just more interconnected. We would also have air travel. It would go across borders. It would be a disaster.
So, yes, it is true. This person was infected because the oral vaccine exists. But then also 37% of in some areas of Rockland County, only 37% of kids in this age group are up to date with their vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
Vaccine rates dropped from 67% in 2020 to 60% in 2022. The reason why this person got polio was because A, they were unvaccinated. B, the oral vaccine exists. And it can and that can mutate and travel around the globe. And C, because the alternative would be millions upon millions upon millions of people getting polio. This is what public health is. This is what public, this is what, like, you know, the idea of herd immunity and the reason why you need to have high vaccination rates. This is why. And the idea that this guy would be safe if it wasn't for the oral vaccine is baby brained, because the number of people who would have polio in this country and around the world would be so incomprehensible.
Yeah. And it's also going to it's going to worsen health outcomes for people who like the people in his audience. Say you're in a community like this one. It's more likely that a virus would mutate and harm you in this particular way. And it doesn't necessarily even need to be polio because of exactly what he's spreading. And then, you know what these same charlatans go around and turn around and do? Then they'll blame those outcomes on vaccinations in the same way that he's doing right now. Right. And I don't know how long the shelf life of that is, because eventually people would start to pick up on it, I would hope. But it doesn't really matter, because if this kind of ideology, and RFK Jr. is currently, Trump picked him for a cabinet selection, he would have enormous power. If this were to actually get implemented, it would be so devastating to basically every family in this country, because it would be normalized by a certain segment of the population, with Jimmy Dore's aiding and abetting there.
Holtenheim, I am the show to say this vaccine discourse is a good example of how the right weaponizes ignorance and stupidity to bog down societal progress towards a more empathetic system. It's truly insane to be arguing about vaccination safety when we know for a fact that tens of thousands of people die each year due to denied care for the sake of profit.
But is it insane if you're trying to discredit the entire concept of public health, say, in a country where people have a crazy reaction to a CEO dying because they all hate the healthcare system? And like, I think that this is clearly the reason that the Koch brothers and all these people, like the right wing adjacent to the anti-vax thing, is because it's like, it's a way to discredit public provisioning of healthcare.
Play that last line by his, you know, co-host or whatever it is, his buddy there. Because this is what people take away when they watch this video. They do not pick up on, like, okay, yes, this oral vaccine can, in extremely rare circumstances, infect somebody who is unvaccinated and cause them polio. But it has all but eradicated polio from the rest of the world. So it's like the idea. I don't even know.
In what lives, it's just crazy.
It's the net lives that have been saved. We can't even calculate, right? Because these are diseases that accelerate as they go around. So we can't even, we have no concept of how bad it could be or what it could have mutated into if it's left alone. Just play that last line because this is what people walk away from.
Vaxxers caused it, is what you're telling me.
Because it's in the oral vaccine.
So pro-vaxxers caused it, is what you're telling me.
All
pro-vaxxers. There's another way of saying the word pro-vaxxer. It is public health or just non-idiots.
Yep. And if this is a big look, because we're talking about this healthcare CEO too, we don't have enough of a concept of public health in this country, in part because we have an extremely privatized system. I think it creates deep resentment in our population that gives an opening to grifters or to
alternative medicine entirely.
Alternative medicine, but also just like people who are selling your health as a consumption choice because people feel like they want to take control over their healthcare in a society that doesn't let you do so in a way that's really expensive.
And the only way you are is as a consumer.
And the only way you are is as a consumer. And so Jimmy Dore used to talk about Medicare for all the time. Has he talked about that recently? And if he has, how does this play into it? Because this is the problem with anti-corruption or anti-establishment politics or about the nefariousness of a certain industry that isn't baked in an anti-capitalist critique or isn't baked into the idea of like building our government in a leftist vision. It's because then you can just critique one industry without basically saying the problem isn't that we vaccinate this country for public health. The problem is that our medicine and our vaccines are captured by corporate conglomerates, and it's why it should be in the public sphere. And it's also why he would never address what you started this conversation with about Dr. Hotez, because he came up and was trying to put forward a public non-big pharma vaccine alternative. But we don't have the infrastructure in this country. And when Donald Trump was president, he certainly wasn't engendering that kind of research. He wanted it all in private hands. And Operation Warp Speed was actually a success at reducing transmission and severity. The big problem with it was that it wasn't owned by the public after we poured billions of dollars into the research for Pfizer, Moderna, and then J&J.
And I just want to make something clear, too. The concept of public health that is in practice when it comes to the polio vaccine is the exact same concept that Medicare for All is foundationed on. Because the idea with Medicare for All, you know, they would talk about these death panels, right? Because what Medicare for All would do is it would say, look, we're going to look at the efficacy of treatments, broadly speaking, across the entire population of the country. And we are going to tell doctors, we're not going to reimburse you for practices that do not lead to better health outcomes for the vast majority of people. It's basically, it's the same concept of public health. There is no doubt in my mind that there are people injured by vaccines. Of course they are. There are people injured by taking Tylenol. There are people injured by taking any medicine. No medicine, no medical procedure is 100% safe. That does not exist. We have not developed that. I don't think you can. People are just too different. But you are treated with a medical treatment or medicine based upon a high rate of efficacy. And when you're talking about stuff that is contagious across a society, that's the way that public health is determined. The reason why rich people don't want a Medicare for All system is because they want to be able to go and they want exclusive access to the best doctor in the in the country. They'll say, like, if our medical system is so bad, why would the prince of, you know, wherever, Saudi Arabia, come here for their X treatment, whatever it is? That's the way they're going to measure healthcare, as opposed to one person getting the best healthcare in the world versus a million getting the second best healthcare in the world, let's say.
Right. So Bobby Kennedy talking about obesity because he's worried about how much people are going to cost him in taxes. Yeah.
And so this is the issue. We don't have access to the healthcare that prince of Saudi Arabia has. And because that prince of Saudi Arabia has access to the best care in the world, the rest of us get substandard healthcare. Means less access, less ability to, less access, whether it's because there's less doctors who will take, your insurance, or because it really comes down to money. And it is the same concept. Yes, there are going to be individuals in a single payer healthcare system who could have conceivably gotten better care. The millionaires and billionaires. They could have conceivably gotten better care. Now, of course, they'll still have their private doctors and they'll work outside the system. But that's the theory. That's the theory. There are people who are not going to be better off. And yes, you will find individuals under a single payer healthcare who will not be better off. But the overwhelming, it's even bigger than overwhelming, majority of people under a single payer healthcare system will be better off. And that is exactly the same dynamic with vaccinations. And to be clear, the immunity that vaccine makers have in our system is mitigated by a special court, which they talk about as being secretive. And to some extent, it is certainly extrajudiciary, but it is to provide awards to people who are legitimately vaccine injured because they are having to pay the price of public health. That's the only way public health exists. It's the only way. There is no other way. Giving people the option of taking a vaccine. Some people do. You have the option for HPV. You have the option to take some, you don't have to take shingles vaccine, for instance. Giving people the option to take a vaccine like the polio vaccine is highly problematic because polio is so devastating and it will continue to mutate. And that's what happened to, had everybody been vaccinated, that person, including, had they been vaccinated, but had everybody around them been vaccinated, that live virus, that oral vaccination would not have killed him. That's just, or I should say paralyzed him. That's just the reality of it.
You asked about what Jimmy Dore and the Medicare for All thing. That died with the March for Medicare for All sort of force the vote sort of thing. But here's one of those sort of Dorites arguing with Matt Binder. For a leftist, it's funny how you don't get what I'm saying. I don't trust the government to implement healthcare because they're too powerful and terrible at everything else. But I want Medicare for All. Like, they're completely out of
get the government hands off my Medicare.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Just fools. Completely idiots.
I want Medicare for All trademark symbol next to it.
Saying, maybe we should do it at a state and local level. I mean,
well, I'm sure they've been very supportive of New York's efforts to publish.
I'm sure they've noticed them.
Yeah, right. Which fingers crossed on that front.
Serious business. They changed as I am. Thanks for the shout out. I'm sure Warren and Luby appreciate it too. I'd also like to pass on a shofar request for Discord member Riv. He's turning 70 today and he's a great member and resource to the community. Folks, check out the Discord. Over 12,000.
Whoa.
At majoritydiscord.com. All right, folks, we have run out of time. Didn't even do a, what does it take? Shooting in Madison, Wisconsin, school shooting, 3 dead, 2 plus the shooter, several others injured, Abundant Life Christian School. All right, folks. I guess we'll see you tomorrow, Bradley, Matt, Emma. Great job today.
Great job tomorrow, too.
And I'm sure just in case I forget tomorrow, great job tomorrow. Bye-bye.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want.
but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light shining bright. I guess somewhere the choice is made. For the option where you don't get paid. For the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow.